Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Michael Lind, who has an article at Salon.com, The Tea Party, the Debt Ceiling and White Southern Extremism. He believes the mainstream media have missed the story, portraying the Tea Party movement in ideological terms rather than regional terms. And while Minnesota's Michelle Bachmann and Illinois' Joe Walsh are the face of the party, the majority of its members in the House of Representatives are white Southern men. Then James Carville joins us. He is a veteran political strategist who helped elect President Bill Clinton twice and is a contributor to CNN. Having described the White House's handling of the Republican-manufactured debt ceiling crisis as a rout from the beginning, James Carville offers up some optimism in terms of an election strategy for the Democrats in 2012, now that John Boehner has proclaimed he got 98% of what he wanted out of the deal. It's Boehner's economy, and just like Harry Truman ran against a do-nothing Congress, Carville argues Obama should run against an all-cuts, no-taxes-on-the-billionaires Boehner Congress. Then we'll get an overseas perspective on how the recently self-inflicted wound to America's economy compares to the very real economic distress in Europe as the Greek crisis migrates to Spain and Italy. Amy Verdun, an expert on European politics at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, joins us. Then finally, now that a determined minority has set the economic course of the nation that is bound to inflict further pain on the many while continuing to reward the few, Jeff Madrick, the author of Age of Greed, joins us to assess the victory of greed over governance. Joining us now is Michael Lind, who is a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. He has an article at Salon.com called The Tea Party, the Debt Ceiling, and White Southern Extremism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Well, thank you for having me on, Ian.
And I suppose I understand, although it's hard to grasp, why the Tea Party, or how the Tea Party movement managed to mobilize the anger of people who found their standard of living declining and somehow channeled it into a campaign to make them worse. And I understand, I suppose, why Rupert Murdoch is able to persuade his viewers of Fox News to vote against their own interest in favor of his. But I don't understand how this predominantly Southern movement is able to campaign and get votes demanding less tax for billionaires and worse health, education, and Social Security for themselves.
Well, I would challenge your premise. I think you're unwittingly falling into the trap of attributing the Tea Party movement to a bunch of ordinary, alienated, largely working-class Americans who are upset by the Great Recession and by the policy responses and are looking for scapegoats. If that were the actual case, if Tea Party were just alienated middle Americans, you would expect an even geographic spread of Tea Party members and also their representatives in Congress. So what I discovered, not entirely to my surprise when I did the numbers, was that if you look only at the House Tea Party Caucus, which is not necessarily representative of all sympathizers of the Tea Party in the country, but it tells you something. These are members of the House of Representatives willing to identify themselves as Tea Party members. 63% are from the South, 19% from the Midwest. The West, the Mountain West, is about 16%. And then technically they're 2% from the Northeast, but that includes a representative from Maryland, which is more or less a southern state, even though it wasn't part of the Confederacy. So clearly what's going on here is a cultural clash between the South and a lot of the Midwestern and Western states and the rest of the country. And I should add that if you count border states, that is, states on the border of the South with large southern populations, then much of your Midwestern Tea Party membership actually should be added to the Southern membership, and you end up with about 75% or three-quarters of House Tea Party members being either from the South or Southern border states. So this is about regional ideology. It's not simply anger on the part of Americans upset with the economic crisis.
So, Michael Lind, if it's not working Americans voting against their own interests, What are the interests then of this Southern-dominated movement?
Well, you can argue that it's against their interests. After all, the South has done very poorly for most middle class and working class and poor Southerners, you know, for two centuries, white and black and Latino alike. So you can still make that argument. But my point was, you have to connect not only the goal of slashing government, at least the federal government, but also the method of trying to bring the federal government crashing to a halt, to a tradition of Southern obstructionism and intransigence that goes all the way back to the 1790s, as I point out, when in the Kentucky resolutions, Kentucky and Virginia claimed that states could nullify federal legislation they didn't like. And in my article, I'm not going to repeat it here, but I go through the whole history of crises over slavery, the Civil War, of course, massive resistance to desegregation during the Civil Rights era. And I see this as part of a pattern. When the Northeast or the Midwest or California and the West Coast lose an election, or they gain one half of one third of the government, which is what the Republicans now control, at least of the three political branches, they don't threaten America's credit rating. They don't shut down the government. They don't just act that way. You know, so I think you have to look at the method as well as the kind of states' rights, traditional small government Southern conservatism as part of a very deeply rooted Southern political culture.
And you argue that this latest of a series of attacks on American democracy by the white Southern minority is a part of a two-century-long effort to paralyze, sabotage, or in the case of the Civil War, destroy American democracy in order to get their way.
When they don't control it, when they control the political branches of the federal government, my fellow Southerners, and I'm a Southerner, are perfectly content with sweeping uses of federal power and prerogative. Mm-hmm. It's only when they lose elections that they try to use their minority position within the government. Not simply, you know, obviously the Democrats as a minority and liberals, you know, engage in strategy too. I don't want to claim that they're blameless. But the sheer brinksmanship that you see of the Tea Party, I think would be quite different even if the Tea Party caucus in the House were mostly New Englanders or people from the West Coast.
So explain to me, because the assumption's always been that the right side won the Civil War, but I'm trying to understand what motivates this kind of rage or this kind of guerrilla kind of approach to governance. I understand, I don't understand, but I'm curious to understand what makes white Southern men tick in as much as
white Southern women as well.
And white Southern women, but going back to the Civil War, right. But going back to the Civil War, it seems to me that the white, ordinary white Southerners, the kind of people who vote for the Tea Party, the blacksmiths and carpenters were ultimately fighting for the plantation owners' right to replace them with slaves. I don't understand this all that kind of right to work mentality. What drives it? Because everybody's not Ashley Wilkes and Rhett Butler.
Well, that's right, and there are actually two Souths. There's the coastal plantation South with large African American populations, and that tended to be the most hierarchical and conservative, and dominated by the planters during the slavery era, and then landlords and big business since then. Then you have the Scots-Irish South. This is the Upland South or the Mountain South, the Appalachia and the Ozarks, all the way down to Texas. And traditionally, this has been a contested area. There have always been a great number of Scots-Irish populists up in the hills who dislike the Southern elites even more than they dislike the Yankees in New York and in Washington. And this is where progressives and liberals make a mistake, in my opinion. It'd be interesting to see what James Carville has to say. When Northern parties, Northern-based parties like Lincoln's Republicans during the Civil War have succeeded, they've always managed to lure away a number of these working-class or rural upland Southern whites away from the Southern oligarchy. And I'm afraid that a lot of progressives and liberals, when they simply denounce particularly the ordinary white Southerners instead of the white elites as idiots or, you know, inbred hillbillies and make jokes like that, you know, these are actually allies that you're alienating. So I want to make that clear.
Well, now, Joe Bajant wrote a very good book about, I don't know whether you read.
It's a brilliant book. It's brilliant.
Yeah, no, he really nailed it.
In fact, I've written defenses of white Southerners before, making the point that it's the political economic system.
Right, deer hunting
which,
with Jesus,
which many
I shouldn't.
Of them are victims that you're against. And in response, I would get letters calling me Jethro, after the hillbilly TV characters. So there's, I don't want to stoke any snobbery, but it's just, it's clear that this is part of the Jefferson Jackson Confederate tradition, which the South was defeated in the Civil War, but in many ways, the defeat of the South, it made it worse in terms of entrenching this political culture, because after the South was defeated, if you were for example, the 19th century, the early 20th century, if you're a Republican now, if you're a Democrat, you're allied with the foreigners, with the outsiders. You're a traitor to your region. And now this mentality is dwindling somewhat as the urban areas in the South expand and as it becomes more ethnically diverse. But it is a force in our politics, and it will be for some time.
And Michael Lind, again, who has an article at Salon.com called The Tea Party, The Debt Ceiling and White Southern Extremism. Clearly, they've exported the supermajority rules that came out of Jim Crow, the Jim Crow era, here to California, which has paralyzed the government here.
Well, it goes back to the federal government, don't they? Well, it goes back to John C. Calhoun, who was the great pre-Civil War statesman of the South. And when he realized the South was a minority in the federal government, he proposed a concurrent majority which would give the South a veto on all federal legislation forever. And essentially, without knowing it, and they've kind of, I don't think, they've consciously doing it, but they basically reinvented the same thing with this super Congress. Essentially, they've given a veto to the Southern-dominated Tea Party minority within the elected branches of the government.
And if they got their wish list, they'd have a constitutional amendment, which would be similar to what paralyzes the state of California.
Exactly.
Try and explain then, if you can, Michael Lind, what is going on with the president? Because I'm going to talk with James Carville about the lack of strategy, because he feels that from day one it's been a rout for the White House.
James may disagree with me. My own view is that just as a lot of today's Republicans were Democrats. They came from the right-wing segregationist wing of the Democratic Party, and then they converted to the Republican Party, like Rick Perry and Tom DeLay. Not that they personally are segregationists, but they came from that right wing of the so-called Dixiecrats. In the same way, I believe that Barack Obama is a Rockefeller Democrat. That is, he and many of his constituents, particularly in the Northeast and New England now, which have become solidly Democratic, their actual political ancestors are not the mid-century New Dealers of like Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Kennedy, and Johnson. But if you go back to people from that political region, it was Rockefeller Republicans. Now, they were very liberal. They were the most liberal people in the country on environmentalism, on race, on feminism, and on various social issues. But at the same time, the New Englanders and the Midwesterners, who used to be moderate Republicans, now they're centrist Democrats. They tend to be fiscal conservatives, and they were never terribly thrilled about Social Security under Roosevelt or about Medicare under Johnson. So I think that instead of treating Barack Obama as an inept Rooseveltian liberal, you should see him as a very successful Rockefeller Republican. And the goals of these Rockefeller Republicans who have captured the presidential wing of the Democratic Party, I think beginning with Carter and then increasingly with Clinton, their goal is to promote social liberalism like gay marriage and environmental policy and green energy and various other liberal social causes, and to combine it with moderate economic conservatism, not radical conservatism. They're not supply-siders. As I say, they're fiscal conservatives. Mm-hmm. But they want balanced budgets, and they want less spending. And it's a coherent combination of social liberalism and economic conservatism, but it is not progressivism.
Well,
you're only at the social side.
But your argument definitely gives another explanation to what just happened. But you're suggesting it wasn't ineptitude.
Both sides wanted it. Yeah, both sides. This is one place where the Dixiecrats and the Rockefeller Republicans agree.
Right.
They agree on cutting back Social Security and Medicare. They disagree about foreign policy to some degree, about gay rights, about abortion and other things. But the people who have been left out, you know, are the populists, the real populists in the South and West in particular, you know, who may be socially conservative, but they support New Deal programs like Social Security and Medicare, and also the genuine progressives.
Well, that both of those blocks voted in 2008. So, are you suggesting that Obama's a hoax?
No, I think that basically progressives made the wrong deal beginning in the 1970s and 80s, because the parties were then in flux with the Republicans losing their the Democrats losing their conservative wings, Northeasterners moving into the Democratic Party. The liberals had a choice. They could have a progressive populist alliance, but that would mean teaming up with a lot of people who don't believe in evolution but support Social Security and Medicare. Because let's remember, there would have been no New Deal and no Great Society without a lot of Southern populists who were quite conservative, and in many cases racist. Mm-hmm. You don't want them. But they were quite religiously conservative and socially conservative, but who supported Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. So you could have had a progressive populist alliance and marginalized the Southern conservatives and the libertarians in the North. But instead, the progressives decided that issues like abortion, gay marriage, environmentalism were more important to them than these entitlements. And so what you thus have the alliance within the present Democratic Party between what I'm calling the Rockefeller Democrats, who are economic conservatives or libertarians, and the progressives. And what holds the Democratic Party together is agreement on social issues and environmentalism and civil rights. But they disagree about economics. And since the big money is on the moderate conservative side, you know, the social liberals, basically, as long as they get things like gay marriage, for example, or gays in the military. And I'm in favor of all of these things. I'm a progressive. Mm-hmm. Right? But I'm just saying, this is what happens. You know, the picture would be radically different if in the 70s and 80s and 90s, the Democrats had decided, you know, we're going to write off all of those socially liberal, economically conservative former Republicans in the Northeast, and we're going to split the South and try to win over the creationists who support Social Security and Medicare.
Well, just in closing then, Michael Lind, since race played a huge part, obviously, in the Civil War and in when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in 1965, he said ruefully that this will be the end of the Democratic Party in the South, and it became a Republican Party, or the Republicans, in fact, are a Southern party, in effect. Race, of course, plays a part in the fact that we have first African-American president. Does that explain the contempt that they have for this man? I mean, it's not...
I think that's mistaken because... Yeah. Now, granted, you have a solid core of racists.
But you've got Mitch McConnell saying he wants this man to fail.
I think you have a short memory, Ian. I mean, ask James Carville. Yeah. They had utter contempt for Bill Clinton.
That's true.
You know, and they staged what was effectively, I call it a coup d'etat, you know, in terms of impeachment, attempted coup d'etat. What you have to understand is because the South was a one-party kind of police state up until the 60s, and I'm not exaggerating, you know, the states had their own secret police units, including my present Texas. They spied on people up until the 50s and 60s. I mean, it was kind of like South Africa. You got what in South Africa was called a logger mentality, right? It's our tribe, the white Anglo-Celtic Southern tribe, against the enemies within, blacks, Latinos, liberals, and the enemies without, the rest of the country. And because of that mentality, you get something very interesting. If you look at self-description in terms of ancestry by Americans, in the Northeast and Midwest, people put down English, European, you know, or German, Irish, Polish, and so on. There's this whole area of the South where people just say American, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, we know they're largely Scots, Irish, and British in descent. But that tells you something. They consider themselves just the Americans. Everybody else is hyphenated, right? Mm-hmm. The white Southerners are the real Americans. And those people, you know, those Italian Americans in New York and the German-American Lutherans in the middle, they're not real Americans. So I think it's much deeper than simply racism. It's this idea that, now, of course, you know, the joke in New York was that people who live in New York think people who live elsewhere can't be taken entirely seriously, right?
So parochialism, the old New Yorker cartoon, right?
There must be something wrong with you.
Right.
So parochialism is not unique to the South, but I do think there's this sense that, and it, you know, I'm from that background. You know, my fellow white Southerners see themselves as representing the true principles of 1776, notwithstanding the Civil War.
So,
you know, that tradition is under attack, and so they despise whoever, you know, the leader of the opposition is, be it Obama or Clinton or anyone else.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who has an article at Salon.com called The Tea Party, the Debt Ceiling, and White Southern Extremism. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with James Carville. Southern man, better keep going.